morning. You're listening to Conservation Corner here on 99.5 FM, KTWHLP, Two Harbors, Minnesota. I'm your host, Emily Nelson, and today is a special episode in anticipation of the fishing opener on May 14th. I've got two guests today, and I'm really excited to present Doug Jensen, the Aquatic Invasive Species Program Coordinator for Minnesota Sea Grant, as well as Mike Scott, who is a Water Resource Enforcement Officer for the Minnesota DNR. We're going to start off talking with Doug Jensen about aquatic invasive species. Welcome, Doug.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
What aquatic invasive species should folks be on the lookout for in Lake County?
Sure. Some of the species that are in our area that we have both in Lake Superior that potentially could move inland, but we also have some species that are in Lake County that could also spread elsewhere, include zebra mussels, spiny water flea, rusty crayfish, curly leaf pondweed, or some of the mystery snails that are out there.
And what are the economic impacts caused by aquatic invasive species?
It really depends upon what sort of scale that you're looking at and time, of course, but it's estimated that in the United States we spend billions and billions of dollars each year on both terrestrial and aquatic invasive species. And while we don't have a good economic assessment for Lake County or even for the state of Minnesota, it is estimated that things like zebra mussels are costing us about $1.12 billion per year for monitoring and control. A lake like Lake Minnetonka 2 years ago spent around $600,000 for control of Eurasian water milfoil just to keep the waterways open and some treatments for using chemicals to keep the Eurasian water milfoil at bay so the boats can get in and out. And even some smaller lakes in western Minnesota to control curly leaf pondweed can spend $225,000 per year. So every lake that we prevent the spread of aquatic invasive species is really a cost savings to our counties in terms of prevention.
Right, that's a great point. I'd like to go through a list of some common aquatic invasive species here in Lake County and talk more specifically about some of the problems that they cause. I've read recently that an invasion of the invasive spiny water flea in Lake Mendota, which is in Wisconsin, is causing cloudy waters and has quite a high economic impact.
Yes, the spiny water flea is causing some devastating impacts there by taking out the native plankton, which then releases a competitive pressure on the algae that's there, and so they're having some harmful algal blooms, which is leading to all sorts of cascading effects in the lake.
And how about the rusty crayfish? They have quite a big impact on aquatic vegetation.
That's right. Rusty crayfish have multiple impacts. They do have major impacts on aquatic plants. They can clear cut out aquatic vegetation. They can hybridize with our native crayfish. They can eat the eggs of our native fish. And when they take away the aquatic vegetation from shoreline areas, that can take away buffer areas for wave and wind action, which then can cause increased shoreline erosion.
What kinds of problems do zebra mussels cause?
Well, zebra mussels cause all sorts of impacts, and fortunately, there's only one water body in the area that's infested, including then Lake Superior. But the three things that make zebra mussels bad is that they can reproduce at a very high rate, around 1 million eggs per season. They can attach to any hard surface, and they can filter 1 liter of water per day. And if we look to Lake Mille Lacs, for example, water clarity in Lake Mille Lacs has increased from 6 feet down to 14 feet, which is having major impacts in part on the walleye fishery that's there. But they can also then colonize onto water intake pipes, and they can clog water intake pipes up to 36 inches in diameter. And they also can get in the water intakes for outboard and inboard motors, and if the water isn't circulating properly in those motors, they can overheat, the manifold can warp, and the engine can be destroyed, causing tens of thousands of dollars. They can also attach to the bottoms of hulls, and they are very, very tough to pull off, and oftentimes if boaters are trying to scrape them off, they'll actually damage the integrity of the paint and of the coatings that are on the hull in trying to scrape them off. So they can cause impacts on a multitude of different levels.
How can we tell the difference between our native mussel species and invasive ones like zebra mussels?
Well, zebra mussels and its cousin, the quagga mussel, which is in the Duluth Superior Harbor, they're the only species that, first of all, have the zebra mussel type coloration on the shell. But most importantly, they're the only ones that attach to hard surface. So they have Bissell threads that allow them to attach, whereas our native mussels don't have that capability.
How big are zebra mussels?
When a zebra mussel first hatches, it's the diameter of a human hair, about 40 microns. And then people will begin to start seeing it on smooth surfaces when it becomes about the size of a peppercorn. Oh. And then from that point on, and at that stage, that's the stage in which they have to find a hard surface, otherwise they don't survive.
What are some of the environmental factors that are necessary for zebra mussels to survive and thrive?
Well, the main drivers for zebra mussels in terms of colonization is they have to have sufficient amount of calcium. And it's generally thought amongst most zebra mussel experts, including myself, is that it takes about 15 milligrams per liter of dissolved calcium in the water for established population. Anything lower than that, the establishment really struggles, and usually if there has been some introduced, they've died out. And there's been at least 10 locations in Lake Superior where zebra mussels have been found, but the only infestations we have right now are in the Duke Superior Harbor and then also up in Thunder Bay, Ontario. The second important factor to consider is temperature, and they have to have a pretty good temperature. Lake Superior itself is pretty cold. It only dropped actually to 36 degrees over the wintertime. And then the third thing is they have to have sufficient food. And if they don't have sufficient food, they don't grow very fast. In inland waters, the growth rate can sometimes be 1 to 2 millimeters per month. Mm-hmm. So it'll take a few months for people to be able to see them growing on a hard surface. But after around 7 millimeters long, that's when they begin to mature, and that's when they begin to produce eggs and sperm, and so that they can then reproduce and cause an infestation.
Are the people heading out to the lake for fishing opener likely to see any aquatic invasive species so early in the season?
Curly-leaf pondweed is one of those aquatic plants that has a real competitive edge over our native plants because it begins to really start to grow under the ice and in darkness in January and February. And so it starts to form those mats, and so once there is ice out, it's basically ready to go. And so it can take over a lot of our native plant communities because it has that ability. The other thing that it has is that it produces a turion, which is kind of it's not really a seed, but it's a vegetative body in which they fall to the bottom, and then they sprout from those turions and grow into new plants. They can also spread when it gets caught on and clinging on boats, motors, and trailers and being transported elsewhere.
And what kind of impacts are we concerned about with curly-leaf pondweed?
They can cause mats that interfere with swimming, boating, waterfall recreation.
What resources are available to help people identify aquatic invasive species?
Well, one of the things that we've done here at Sea Grant is produce a number of different types of aquatic invasive species watch identification cards. So if you go to a bait shop, you can go online, you can go on our website, and that'll help you get and be more aware of the different species that we have in our area. But basically, if you see anything that looks suspicious, report it to Sea Grant or report it to the DNR. Mm-hmm. It is illegal to possess and transport aquatic invasive species in Minnesota unless you are bringing it in for positive identification. So if you're able to take a sample, maybe take a picture, send it to us, but hold on to the sample and identify exactly where you found that potential infestation, that's really helpful in terms of helping us identify new infestations.
What are some common ways that aquatic invasive species spread?
The three main ways in which many of these aquatic invasive species can spread is as plants or on plants, clinging to boat, motor, and trailer, attached to hulls of watercraft, and also then in water that may be transported. And in terms of the relative risk between those three things, the first two are really, really important because they provide the opportunity for probably the greatest risk for establishment elsewhere. However, it is important also to remove any water that's on board, including leaving out your plug at the water access as you're leaving, to make sure that all water is removed from there and any other water containing devices, because it is the law in Minnesota. We do have the pull the plug law here to help prevent the spread of things like zebra mussels and spiny water fleas, those things that are very difficult to see by naked eye.
What programs are out there right now that are helping prevent the spread of aquatic invasive species?
The Stop Aquatic Hitchhikers campaign was launched nationally in 2002, and it's been a huge success. It's our Smokey the Bear, if you will, in terms of conservation efforts related to aquatic invasive species. there's over 2,500 partners nationwide, and there's probably a couple hundred just in Minnesota. And it's been very effective because it brings together a partnership to help convey the same message, a uniform message to all boaters and anglers, making sure that they're clean, drained, dry every time, everywhere. And there's a couple of things that people need to consider as boaters. If you're out on the water for just a day, it's impossible for sea mussels to attach to your boat motor and trailer because you're underway, and it takes 24 hours for sea mussels in stagnant water to attach. So as long as you're always doing the cleaning off the aquatic plants, any organisms that are on the hull of your boat, and you're removing any mud before you're leaving the access, that's one of the most important things that you can do. And our surveys are showing that over 90%, 95% of the people are doing that. Disposing of any unwanted bait, fish parts and worms in the trash is also a really important thing. Draining any water that's on board, leaving the plug out, as I mentioned earlier. And then if you're out on the water and your boat remains on the water for more than a day, then there's some added precautions that you should take. You should rinse off and wash off your boat. Even taking a garden hose is a really good thing to do to remove anything that might be on board, and basically getting it off the boat, the motor, and the trailer, and using high-pressure hot water. If you're on sea mussel-infested waters, it's a good idea to use 140-degree water for 30 seconds or 120-degree water for 1 minute. The last thing that you can do is that you can let your boat dry for at least 5 days, and that's just a really good precaution because once you've removed anything that's visible on there, you've removed any life stage that can survive the longest period of time out of the water. And between those five steps, it's probably one of the reasons why we've had such great success in preventing the spread of aquatic invasive species in Minnesota.
Well, I really want to thank you for joining me today, Doug.
Thank you for having me.
I would just like to remind everyone, you're listening to Conservation Corner on 99.5 FM, KTWHLP, Two Harbors, Minnesota. I'm Emily Nelson, and this is our Fishing Opener Special. I've just been talking with Sea Grant's Doug Jensen about aquatic invasive species. And now we're going to switch gears a bit and talk about some of the fishing rules and regulations with Minnesota DNR Conservation Officer Mike Scott. Thank you so much for joining me today, Mike. What are some of Minnesota's main bait laws?
Well, Minnesota's got quite a few of them. The biggest one people need to be aware of is we're not allowed to import live bait from out of state, period. All bait that you purchase that's live has to be purchased from a vendor in Minnesota, and that can only be used in Minnesota as live bait. And that's pretty big. Some people don't realize that. Being a border waters with Wisconsin, some people like to bring it from there. Not allowed to. Only Minnesota bait. And that's because of a lot of the invasive species issues that we have, specifically tailored towards the viral hemorrhagic septicemia, and that's in Lake Superior. So a lot of the bait that we do use is susceptible to that disease, the VHS, as we call it, and the VHS alone is something because they're a susceptible species, we don't allow them to come from out of state. Try to preserve that so that we have fish that are coming from a stock that do not have VHS in them, so we don't spread that around the state.
And building off of that, can people use smelt for bait?
Yes, they can. Yes and no. There's a question that comes up a lot, and especially this time of year, because smelting will be kicking off here soon down in Lake Superior, so we're looking at that coming up. Most people come up to collect smelt for consumption, and that's the big thing. But there are those that take it for bait. Smelt can be used for bait taken anywhere in the state in Lake Superior only, period, because Lake Superior has so many invasive species issues with it, and the viral hemorrhagic septicemia that's out there, if you collect smelt from Lake Superior, you can use them in Lake Superior below what we call the posted boundaries. All rivers and streams in Lake Superior have a boundary where fish can't get up past that. So from those boundaries down, we allow them to use smelt. With that said, inland lakes and stuff, they're not allowed to use it unless that smelt has been processed to inactivate that viral hemorrhagic septicemia. I know it sounds like a lot, but basically we're trying to kill the disease so that you can use that bait inland and not spread that disease somewhere else. And the only ones that are allowed to do that are commercial operators that have a permit from the state of Minnesota to preserve that bait. Now, there are places that sell bait from out of state, and they are allowed to bring it into state, being it's a dead bait, but it has to meet the standards by Minnesota that it comes from a VHS, which is the viral hemorrhagic septicemia, disease-free water, and that it's been inactivated to by our standards, doesn't contain that disease anymore. And there's packaging that comes with that. With that packaging, because they have this smelt, the angler is required to keep that packaging with them at all times so that we can prove the best we can that this stuff is not infested, it came from a reliable source, and this person is okay to use that. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot to swallow, I realize. So there's yes and no questions to smelt. The same rule applies to Cisco's, which is another form of bait that people use. Same rules exactly.
What are the main things you're looking for as a conservation officer?
In Minnesota, we also, and I know Doug, you talked with Doug Jensen, and he's a great resource for aquatic invasive species, and he's just knowledgeable. I'm sure he talked about some, but from an enforcement standpoint, being a conservation officer, things that we look at for people in the springtime is cleaning your boats. It's not transporting aquatic invasive species. The biggest thing we run into is people that still have the drain plugs in their watercraft. Back 5-6 years ago, Minnesota passed a law that says no drain plugs are allowed in boats. All drain plugs and bailing plugs have to be removed from boats so that all water that's contained within those vessels drains out or will drain out when they're moving around. And that, again, is just to protect the waters around the state from zebra mussels, spiny water flea, and some of these other critters that we have that we're trying to keep out of our waters. Every year we get that from people. We stop and we talk to them, and some we have to educate, some we take enforcement action on. It depends on the situation. People are getting better with it, much better, but it's something because it's a new year, they're excited about fishing, they're getting their boat ready to go, they forget that little tidbit. So we want to make sure that they get that drain plug out.
I was wondering what have been your observations. As far as the new rules and regulations regarding aquatic invasive species, have you seen any changes in people's behavior?
You know, it has. It started when I first started doing this about 7 years ago. There was this wall that was put up, and people were trying to change human behavior is a challenging thing. And it's not that we're trying to be doing this in a mean way. It's the educational component to get out there to preserve these waters that people want to use from now through the eternity for our grandkids, to keep them the way they are, that we have them, so we keep them pristine and usable for all forms of recreation, not just fishing, but boating, canoeing, you know, some people snorkeling and scuba diving and other things. So it's out there for them.
Mm-hmm.
We've had resistance from people because they go, well, nothing we can do to stop this. Well, that's not true. We're going to slow it down, and we're going to slow it down to let science catch up and find that magic bullet that can resolve some of these issues. But we can't do it alone. And it's not the DNR trying to do this. This is the people of the state that have spoken. And we're the conduit. We're the enforcement arm of that to get these waters. So we're paid to do what the vast majority of Minnesotans want to do, to protect their waters.
Mm-hmm.
It's a challenge. People sometimes don't like change. I get that. But when you understand the big picture, fast forward 8 years, people understand as they start seeing a few more lakes getting infested how important this is. They understand now the more information that we have and we pass on, that they understand what's at risk here. So the attitude has changed from, oh, one more thing to do, I can't believe this, I got all this to do, to, well, that makes sense. That's a problem. It's a couple minutes, yeah. And they actually start telling other people at the access. And I've seen that, where I've watched people actually say, hey, you need to get that off there. Oh, yeah, I haven't got that far yet. Or they call me and say, yeah, I was down there. This guy's from here. I know they can't have this, but they took off with a boatload of this stuff. And, you know, and we'll go find them and track them down and do an educational stop if we can and kind of address the issue.
Mm-hmm.
So it's changed a lot. It's gotten better. I think I see it as a positive thing. It is something that does challenge some people because we're dealing with their human behavior, things that are entrenched and we're used to doing, and we understand that. But overall, you know, people just need to make the change.
So back to talking about bait. Say you're fishing on one lake and you're not having much luck, and so you'd like to go and try your luck on another lake. What do you need to do with your bait?
Great question, and that's probably one of the bigger questions I get, because bait being restricted to Minnesota waters, you can only get it in Minnesota. It's not cheap. It's not expensive, but it's not something you want to throw away. And we tell people, we don't want your bait. What we're trying to prevent is the transport of water. In the state of Minnesota, you're not allowed to transport water from any body of water anywhere in the state, period. So with that in mind, when you go out fishing, people got their minnows and stuff. Even though they don't touch the water, they keep them in containers, they don't get into lake water, it's still an unknown. So when they leave the lake, they can't take that water with them, and which is fine. We tell them, bring water with you from home. This is the easiest thing to do. Fill up a gallon jug, bring it from home, make sure it's non-chlorinated water or something that's not going to kill your fish, you know, or your bait. Leave it in your vehicle. Don't put it in the boat, because if you take it in the boat with you, again, we don't know where that water came from. Leave it in your vehicle. When you're done cleaning your boat at the end of the day, you get it out, you drain it, get everything ready to go. The last thing you need to do is take your minnows, drain all the water out, take the fresh water, pour it in with those minnows and stuff, head on out. You're good to go. We leave that up to the individual anglers. Again, this is the best thing we can do for them to keep their bait and still, you know, fish.
What are some of the other big questions that you're asked?
Other ones, you know, we get into what we call the limits of fish, which hasn't changed in the years, but it's possession limit. And in Minnesota, we allow you to take so many fish. Say walleyes, you're allowed to keep six. You can catch six per day per person, but your possession limit is six fish, which means that you can have six fish and only have six in possession. So until you eat those fish or consume them, as we talk, or take and give them away or do something else with them, you've got six fish in possession. You can't go fishing for them anymore. So you have to find another species. The only exception to that is the yellow perch, which we allow you 40 in possession, but only 20 per day. So you can go for 2 days and fish and get up to 40, but once you hit the 40 mark, your possession limit's reached, and then you need to find a way to start eating them. Yeah. And moving on. Another question we get, especially when we get into the tourist season, we get folks coming from out of state, bringing their families up, and it's great bringing them in to fish and stuff. Families that come in with their kids to fish, with the kids under 16, the parents are required to buy a fishing license. The kids can fish under their parents' fishing license, but their limit that they get, the parent can have six fish, the kids can't keep their own limit. The limit they catch counts towards the parents' limit. Where in Minnesota, if you're a resident under the age of 16, you don't need a license and you can catch your own limit of fish. It doesn't have to have a parent or guardian over the age of 18. So out of state, they have to have that. A lot of people don't know that, and I've run into quite a few of them, and mm-hmm. I don't want to rain on their parade or ruin their vacation and stuff, but it becomes an educational thing. What we tell them to do is we have a license that the kids can buy, or they can buy for their kids. It's $5. It's a youth license, $5. They can keep their own limit, and there is no issue anymore.
So usually the fishing opener falls on Mother's Day weekend, but this year it's a little bit different with the fishing opener the weekend after Mother's Day. There is a Take Your Mother Fishing Day that's on Mother's Day, however.
Yes, it's Mother's Day because traditionally fishing openers always fell on Mother's Day. My wife and I know others have been a little adamant about some days like that. State did it, so they've tried to modify that. Take a Mother's Fishing is Mother's Day, and a mother can take their kids and go out fishing. Thing is, you're only allowed to fish for those species which are open at that time. You can't fish for non-open species. So because it's a week earlier, that leaves crappies and sunfish, rock bass, underutilized fish such as carp and suckers that you can catch and keep, but not walleyes and northerns, those that are seasons that are closed. So go out, have fun, and enjoy it, but remember the only season that's open is those fish that are open at that time.
Do you have any other advice for people heading out fishing?
Those coming into the state, I guess the biggest thing is I don't doubt you talk with Doug Jensen. Again, he's very informative. Aquatic invasive species is the top of our list on a lot of things, and we're getting a lot of pressure from the public, and rightly so, to enforce some of these rules. Being in enforcement, we like to do things the best we can to get education and compliance versus the long arm of the enforcement where citations are written. Sometimes we have to do both. Biggest thing, and people coming out of state, they don't understand the rules sometimes. This year, there's a new one. It'll be in effect, and it probably won't be opening fisher, but where non-residents coming in and buying a license are going to have to sign off on a validation form that says they understand the aquatic invasive species issues in Minnesota, and they accept the rules so that they abide by them as they go through the state or with their tourists, whatever they're doing. It's new this year because it puts them on notice that these are rules and we do hold them accountable even if they're from out of state. You're still required to know what the rules are in this state to participate. Pull your drain plug. Big thing is pull that drain plug. Drain your boat, clean it up, get rid of all that vegetation. We know what it's called. We call it vegetation. Everybody calls it weeds. Same thing, coming out of the lake and stuff. Clean those off so you're not transporting them. And make sure when you go to the next body, you're not bringing something that wasn't there already. It's real quick and easy, real simple, and if we do have something in that lake, you sure don't want to bring it back to your state and be that person.
No, you certainly don't. You're providing us with a lot of great information.
Yeah, it's going to have a lot of information. Fishing has a lot. You know, when I encourage a lot of people during fishing and stuff, especially when it gets to that time, watercraft, make sure your watercraft's up to speed. Go through and check your boat before you get to the access and you become that person that everybody's watching because your boat's not running or you forgot to do this or, you know. Get it up and running beforehand if you can and do all these maintenance things. Also, when you get the boat out, check it for safety. Make sure that you've got all your life jackets. Very important. Kids 10 and under are required to wear one at all times and around the water. Above that, we encourage it. Like I tell parents, if you wouldn't put your kids in a car without a seatbelt, why would you put them in a boat without a life jacket? It's not a requirement past 10, but it's a very good idea to have that on board. Check your boat again, too. Make sure it's running. Make sure you got the proper gas. You've got a fire extinguisher if you're required to, that it's operational. Check it to make sure it's not plugged. People put them in there, they see it, but they don't check them. Check that. If you're on the waters of Lake Superior, which some people do, there's other regulations that apply for flares and safety devices. Please consult the regulation book if you're out there. But overall, go out and have fun. But make sure you've got all this done ahead of time, so when you get to the water, you don't have to worry about it. It's there. Jump in, go out, go fishing, have a good time, and you don't have anything to worry about.
Where can folks go to find information on the rules and regulations regarding fishing and boating?
All our rules and stuff are planted in the synopsis that we get yearly. We have a fishing synopsis, and we also have a boating regulation book, which doesn't change much because it's based on the federal doctrine. But all those can be found at your local sports store. The synopsis for fishing can be found in any convenience stores that has an electronic licensing sales that sells our licenses, have these books. And if all else fails and you got time on your hands, go to the internet, the DNR website, and all this stuff is on there too, just as well. You can also, at that time, make sure you have a fishing license. I know that sounds kind of strange, but sometimes that's one of the things that people just, it slips their mind. Either they leave it at home or they forget it. We've made it easier now, and most states are, because of technology and smartphones. You can actually purchase your license online. If you do that, I encourage you to do that. You can keep a copy on your phone, and that'll be good for us. A paper copy can be sent to you later so that you have that in possession, but you need to have that with you. Leaving it at home or leaving it at the cabin is not acceptable because we need to verify who it is, and we don't have the time sometimes to go through and check every person and go on the internet and stuff. Minnesota law requires you to have it with you. With the advent of smartphones, it's pretty easy to do, so do that ahead of time. Make sure you bring that with you.
What are your recommendations for people up in the boundary waters who are moving from lake to lake and taking their bait with them?
Yeah, that's actually a very good question. And that's Minnesota has got a bunch of unique different areas in the state. And when the laws were created, they created them so that everybody would have to follow the same set of rules. Unfortunately, with Minnesota, we also have the boundary waters canoe area. Out there, some people still take live bait with them, and that's fine. They can do that. But there are some requirements because of the way we're allowed to transport water in the state. Again, you can have your minnows. You just can't take the water with you. So here's what we've done with people in the boundary waters and explained to them. When you come to that portage, you get ready to go, take and clean up all your gear, get everything packed up as you go into the next portage. Take your minnows with the water you've got in them and head on out. Once you get to the other side, the end of that portage, we're asking you, 50 feet or maybe 100 feet away, take and get all your gear down, get ready to go, take and drain all the water out of your minnows and stuff that you can get out of that, drain it all out on the ground, then go out to that body of water. It's only a few steps away. Refill it up with the water that you're at and continue on your way. And what we're trying to do there is, again, give you a way to mitigate the transfer of aquatic invasive species from one lake to another, but we need you to do this. Like I tell people, you're not going to hurt the DNR. This isn't something we're doing to make us feel better. This is for you and protecting your waters, and this is the best solution we have for you so that you can continue on and take that bait with you.
Do you have any last suggestions for people heading out fishing?
Check the rule book a lot. Read through it, peruse through it real quick. If you have questions, contact any conservation officer in the area, go down to the fisheries office, or even go on the DNR website, ask questions or find it. If you don't know who your conservation officer is, there's a CO Finder webpage on the DNR website. If you can pick that up and then point to the city that you're in, it'll tell you who the conservation officer is in that area and a phone number. You can contact them. Ask us questions. We're happy to help. That's what we're here for. It's easier to ask me ahead of time than it is to explain it to me out there. Well, I thought I could do this. We're here to help. We're not trying to jam you up. We just want you to have a good time and follow the rules.
Well, thank you so much for joining me.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
And thank you for tuning in to Conservation Corner on 99.5 FM, KTWHLP, Two Harbors, Minnesota. This program was produced by Lake County Soil and Water Conservation District with funding from the Clean Water, Land, and Legacy Amendment. I'm Emily Nelson, and I hope you have a wonderful afternoon.